So yes, welcome to Sangha Night, the rebirth of Sangha Night. So this year at the Buddha Center is the year of the Buddha, and for Sangha Night throughout the whole year we're going to concentrate on the Buddha. So the whole year will be on the Buddha. The first 3 or 4 months we have some talks. I'll be doing a talk tonight on the four sites. So we're starting with Siddhartha, really, before the enlightenment. There will be a talk in a few weeks' time on going forth, then a talk on the enlightenment of the Buddha, and then a talk called What Buddhas Do, which Maitreyi will come to speak to us about. What Buddhas Do. And over the summer months, I want to look at the Pali Canon, more suttas from the Pali Canon and the Buddha in the Pali Canon. So that's what we'll be exploring. Of course, Sangha Night is not just about talks. In some ways, you could say that maybe the most important bit of Sangha Night is the tea break, not the talks. It's getting to know people, chatting, creating a sense of community, creating a spirit of community. That's, in a way, what Sangha Night's about most. But there are a lot of people involved with this centre. I mean, there are probably around this centre, probably 100 order members. There's nearly 200 mitras, and then there are many more people as well. So there are a lot of people involved with this centre, and probably none of us know all of them. Yeah, we tend to know the group that we've done a course with, or the group that we study with, or whatever. So we tend to know a smallish number. Maybe if we've been here for many, many years, we may get to know 50 or 100 or even 150 people if we're really extrovert. The other thing, of course, most Buddhists are not extroverts. They tend to be introverts. So that Sangha Night is even more necessary for introverts. I'm one. So yes, the reason I say that is because it's lovely to see you all here tonight, and I know you've come because it's the first evening, it's the launch of Sangha Night, and hopefully you've come to hear me speak as well. And I imagine we'll get lots of people to come for talks and so on. But actually, as I say, it's not just about that. There is sometimes a danger at any Buddhist centre that talks and so on become a kind of a form of entertainment, as it were. You come to listen to a talk in the same way as you watch a movie or something like that. It's something quite passive. But Sangha Night needs to be more active than that. And other evenings we'll have more active interaction between us, exploring the themes from the talks, exploring the theme of the year. So I do hope you'll come along and engage with that and engage with me. I can see Yvonne is not happy.
Yeah, I'm just going to put it here.
Okay. Yes, so we've got a few things lined up over there. This week I'll be talking on the four sites, and next week we'll probably go more deeply into the topic of inspiration. You'll see the connection later on. And then the week after that, Subhadramati is coming to give a talk on going forth. So Subhadramati is the Mitra Convener for Women at the London Buddhist Centre. She's also author of a book on ethics called Not About Being Good. She's also a preceptor. She's also from Glasgow. What more could you want? And she's a very good friend of mine. So I hope you'll all come to hear Subhadramati as well. And I'll tell you more about other speakers coming as the weeks go along. And also, on a practical note, for the first few months of this class, we've got this room. After the end of March, we've also got the theatre. So, actually, it's not too bad, is it? It's not too much of a squeeze, but there are about 50 people here, so it's not too much of a squeeze. We can take you. I hope you're comfortable, reasonably comfortable. But we will have the theatre after March, so hopefully we'll get even more people. Okay, so the four sites from the story of Siddhartha. This story, I'll tell you the story in a minute, but just to say that this story appears in the Pali Canon. It appears in a sutta in the Digha Nikaya. But there, it's not a story about Siddhartha at all. It's a story told by the Buddha about somebody else, about a previous Buddha. Yeah? I think it's called the Mahapadana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya. And the story then turns up in a long poem by Ashvaghosha called the Buddhacharita, which is from the 2nd century of the Common Era. And it's been embellished quite a lot, this story. And in the Buddhacharita, in fact, it says in the Buddhacharita, in the story, it says that when Siddhartha went and out and saw these four sights, actually nobody else could see them. The gods put them in front of him. Nobody else could see what he was seeing. So this is a story, the four sights, and stories are important. They're important because they're an aid to memory, so they were very, very important for an oral tradition, which Buddhism was for a long time. They're an aid to memory, but they're also important because they have an emotional impact, that lots of concepts and ideas may not have. However, the really dangerous thing with stories is that too often people take them literally. So people take what's symbolic as literal. And history and even current affairs show that people are willing to die and to kill to uphold literal interpretations of their religious stories or their national stories. But stories, nevertheless, are of fundamental importance. They're really important to humanity. I just have the current edition of Utona magazine with me, which is the storytelling issue. It's a really good issue, actually. I've just read it. I didn't know that Ratnagarbha, who edits it, was going to be sitting right in front of me. So it is.
Hold it up.
I really enjoyed reading it. But in the current edition of Utona, it quotes Philip Pullman. Most of you have probably heard of Philip Pullman. He's quoted as saying, "After nourishment, shelter, and companionship, stories are the thing we need most in the world." And Ratnagarbha, who's the editor, as I said, he adds in the editorial, he says, "Stories are the primary way in which the imagination orientates the sum total of our available psychic energy towards one goal or another. The motifs of myths and stories are found to have great significance for the difficult task of forging an individual identity, an individual destiny in relationship with the deepest dimensions of consciousness." That's right, Ratnagarbha said that, not me. To find out more, read Utona. So here's the story of the four sights. Siddhartha is a prince. I'm not going to tell the full embellished story, just the brief story. So Siddhartha is a prince. His father, Suddhodana, is the king or the chieftain. And at the birth of Siddhartha, a prediction is made that he will be either a great king or a great holy man. And his father naturally wants him to follow in the family business. He wants him to be a great chieftain, a great king. So Siddhartha grows up leading a very privileged and sheltered life. There's a palace for the winter, a palace for the summer, and so on. And he's always surrounded by entertainments and diversions of one kind or another. Music, dancing girls, the best of food, clothing, everything. He's got it. But he gets bored, and he has a vague feeling of unease. So he wants to go out and see the world. And he persuades his charioteer, Chanda, to take him out into the city. And his father, King Suddhodana, hears about this and makes sure that everything is tidied up and that people line up and cheer dutifully when Siddhartha goes out into the city. So just like any royalty going out into the city, everything's tidied up, etc. However, the gods put an old man in the path of the prince, bent, decrepit, leaning on a stick, an archetypal old man. And the prince is shocked. He's never seen anything like this before. And he asks Chanda, his charioteer, his chauffeur, what's happened to the man? And Chanda explains to him what old age is. So old age is ubiquitous. Old age is everywhere. And Prince Siddhartha realizes that he too will grow old. Then the same thing happens on subsequent occasions with a sick person and a corpse. So Siddhartha suddenly becomes hyper aware of old age, sickness and death. And all the entertainments, all the fun and games lose their appeal for him. Then on a fourth trip out, he sees a wandering mendicant, a holy man. And the tranquility and the contentment of this man make a huge impression on him. And not long after that, he resolves to leave the palace and go off on a quest to find or to discover the meaning of life and what can be done to alleviate the suffering of old age, sickness and death. So that's the basic story. There are lots of embellishments on the story. If you look in the Buddha Charita, there's lots of embellishments. It's a long story. Some people have looked at this story and they've criticized Siddhartha. They've criticized him for leaving his wife and child and heading off on this quest. Pure selfishness, they say. And others have tried to justify his decision, saying that he did it out of compassion for humanity. But, as I said, it's very, very unlikely that anything like this ever happened in the first place, ever happened literally. This is a story, this is a legend, this is a myth, and arguments about whether Siddhartha was right or wrong to go off like that are beside the point. They fail to understand the symbolism of the story. So the importance of the story is its symbolism, not the details. It's not a factual story. In fact, in the Pali Canon, when the Buddha does talk about his own past and leaving home and so on, this is what he says. It's much simpler. He just says, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I thought, house life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy living in a household to lead a holy life as utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow cloth, and went forth from the house life into homelessness. Later, while still young, a black-haired boy, blessed with youth, in the first phase of life, I shaved off my hair and beard, though my mother and father wished otherwise and grieved with tearful faces. And I put on the yellow cloth and went forth from the house life into homelessness. Homelessness. So that's what he says about his own life. When he was very young, it sounds like to me, it sounds like he was possibly still in his teens, the first phase of life, it says. He decided to go forth, and his mum and dad were upset. Seems kind of straightforward story in a way. So the point here is that the story of the four sites is not important as a piece of biography or as a piece of history. But it is very important. It's important because it has spiritual significance for all human beings. It's about that impetus, you could say the impetus to undertake the only work that is truly worthy of human consciousness, the work of becoming more aware. You could say, for instance, that in a similar way, the Christian story, the story of the virgin birth, the flight into Egypt, the resurrection and so on, all of that has spiritual significance if one understands the symbolism. So taking stories like these, the four sites or the Christian story, taking them literally only feeds fanaticism and religious fanaticism is a noxious poison, really. And religious fanaticism can be in any religion. It appears in Buddhism too, unfortunately. So the first three sites that Siddhartha sees, the old man, the sick person, and the corpse, they represent dukkha. They represent the unsatisfactoriness of existential existence, the existential situation. And then the fourth site represents the antidote to this unsatisfactoriness. So two of the sites represent something inevitable. Sickness is inevitable, and death is inevitable. The other two are not inevitable. Not everyone reaches old age. And embarking on a spiritual journey is a choice that actually probably very few people make, if you count the 6 billion or whatever on the planet. So the story of Siddhartha is telling us that power is not a source of security. It's telling us that great wealth is not a source of security. Having children is not a source of security, as his parents find out. Pleading with the gods is not a source of security. None of these save us from the unsatisfactoriness of sickness and death. In fact, they all make the facts of sickness and death more monstrous and unbearable, because there's so much to lose. So old age, sickness and death represent dukkha. They're symbols of dukkha. They're graphic physical events and images that everyone can relate to. But we mustn't be too literal-minded about it. It is not that dukkha equals old age, sickness and death. Yeah? They represent the unsatisfactoriness of life. They represent impermanence. They represent the fact that nothing lasts. You don't last. Health doesn't last. Life doesn't last. But in a way, that even that is not dukkha. That's not what dukkha is. What makes it unsatisfactory, what makes it painful, what makes it dukkha, is that we don't want it to happen. That's what makes it dukkha. We don't want impermanence. We don't want aging, illness and death. We don't want insecurity. We want things to turn out well and to stay that way. Often we want what we want and not what we get. And that is dukkha. That's unsatisfactoriness. So we don't need to dwell much on dukkha, really, because it's something that we all experience in one way or another. But perhaps the most important of the four sites is the fourth one, the wandering mendicant. So what does he symbolize? What's the universal significance of this image? So the wandering mendicant represents the fact that there is an alternative to the life of unsatisfactoriness. There's an alternative to dukkha. So we become aware of our suffering, whether it's the suffering of loss or insecurity, or the suffering of lack of meaning, or just some vague unease about life, some vague unease with the life around us and the life we live. And that uneasiness, that suffering, that niggling lack of something can motivate us to go in search of something better. That was certainly what happened in my own case. I felt the dissatisfaction, the unease, the dukkha. But actually at the time, when I was in my early 20s or late teens, I had absolutely no idea of any alternative. Nothing around me seemed to give any answer. But nevertheless, I felt an imperative to look for an alternative. I felt as if I had no choice. I don't know if this is a common feeling, but I felt as if I had no choice. Life just seemed absurd to me, and I had to find a meaning to it all, or I couldn't see how I could carry on. Maybe not everyone is as extreme as I was as a young man. So I gave up everything when I was 22. I retired from life. But the principle is there. Suffering, unease, lack of meaning, loss, insecurity. Something like this can be what motivates us to search for meaning, or to search for truth, or to search for beauty, whatever. In a way, this is one reason why we shouldn't always try to alleviate, too quickly at least, the suffering of others. Or even our own suffering, because I think it's the German poet Rilke says we can squander our suffering. There's value in suffering if awareness can be brought into it. Sometimes the suffering is not anything at all tangible. It's just a feeling of the needs. There must be more. There must be more to life than this. There must be more. There's a poem by Tarkovsky, who made who's a filmmaker. His father wrote a poem called "But There Has to Be More." I could read a little bit for you. Do you want like a poetic interlude? Yeah. Okay, but there has to be more. Now summer is gone and might never have been. In the sunshine it's warm, but there has to be more. It all came to pass, all fell into my hands like a five-petaled leaf, but there has to be more. Nothing evil was lost, nothing good was in vain, all ablaze with clear light, but there has to be more. Life gathered me up, safe under its wing, my look always held, but there has to be more. Not a leaf was burnt up, not a twig ever snapped. Clean as glass is the day, but there has to be more. So that's Arseny Tarkovsky. Now, not everyone is motivated by dukkha. Some people are motivated by a vision of truth or beauty or goodness, a vision of a better world. And even if we're given, as it were, a kickstart by dukkha, for most of us, it becomes necessary at some point to have something to inspire us, to lead us forward. We may spend quite a lot of time, as it were, backing away from suffering, moving away from suffering. But at some point we need to turn around and start to move towards something. We need a sight, as it were, of an alternative to suffering. So the four sights work together as a whole. It's a complete image. The awareness of suffering represented by the first three sights, and the inspirational vision represented by the fourth sight. And together, the four of them provide this impetus and energy to keep us on the spiritual path. So the awareness of dukkha, as I said, is relatively straightforward. at least in its grosser manifestations. It might actually be not so easy to understand or see the dukkha of being attached to a fixed self-view, or the dukkha of maintaining a sense of ego separateness or something like that. But the dukkha of loss, the dukkha of insecurity is quite palpable for anyone who pauses to think and feel. But inspiration or vision or faith to pursue a spiritual life is perhaps a bit less straightforward, a bit less obvious. So when I say a spiritual life, what I mean is a life dedicated primarily to the growth and development of consciousness. The growth and development of consciousness beyond craving, beyond hatred, beyond ignorance, beyond fear. So it's about consciously evolving a consciousness that requires no security, that expands into a flowering of compassion. And this means going beyond attachment to self, going beyond attachment to a fixed and separate self-identity. So to do this, we need to be inspired by the vision of a higher life, a vision even of a higher self, you could say. Or, changing the metaphor, a vision of a more expansive self, a more expansive life. So what inspires us? Indeed, what inspires you? What inspires you? It may well be that there are as many inspirations as there are people, or at least as many inspirations as there are inspired people. Different things inspire different people, and different things inspire us at different times in our life and different stages of our development. So when I first got involved with Sri Ratna, what inspired me, what I first heard about Sri Ratna, what inspired me was the vision, the idea of a new society. That's what inspired me. I read Subhuti's book Buddhism for Today, which at the time was a history of the movement up to that time. So it was a history of a movement which was only 16 years old at the time. So pretty precocious thing to be doing, writing a history at 16, like a 16-year-old writing their autobiography. But in that history, there was an expression given to this idea of the new society, which I really, really, really appealed to me. I just quote a little bit from that book. I haven't read it for a long time, but I just quote a bit from Buddhism for Today. It says, "The experience of a retreat is a taste of a whole new way of life lived in the midst of a whole new society. A whole new society and economic and social network built up in order to provide the best possible conditions for human growth." The creation of a new society is the purpose of Sri Ratna. It is unlikely that in any part of the world such a society could ever become coextensive with society as a whole. However, a number of such ideal societies in miniature, existing in the midst of the wider social context, can help those who are in contact with them to grow as human beings and can provide a model for others. The work which order members and others undertake to bring about these ideal conditions is, it might be said, the political aspect of Sri Ratna. The foundation and dissemination of the social environment in which many people are free to develop is, in the last analysis, the only solution to the problems of the crisis-laden world. To work at one's own development and to seek to help others by creating the institutions and conditions in which as many people as possible can grow is the social and political platform of Sri Ratna. So that was the kind of thing that inspired me when I was in my 20s, the idea of personal development, personal growth and development, but also that influencing or creating a community, a society, and that having an influence beyond that. It was something that I had been inspired by before I ever came across Buddhism. But in Tri Ratna in particular, I found it articulated, and more importantly, I found it practiced in a way that I hadn't encountered before. I lived in West Berlin in the early 1980s, and at that time Berlin was a place which had lots of alternative communities and communes, and I was very much involved with that. It was a very idealistic kind of place, but I could also see that the people involved with these projects and communes and so on were often very individualistic, and they had all sorts of different motivations that tended to hold back the projects that they were involved with. And the difference I noted in Tri Ratna was the overarching idea of spiritual growth and development. I remember Bhante used to use this phrase in so many of his talks, the phrase growth and development, personal growth and development. And it was an idea that was there running through everything, that overarching idea of spiritual growth and development. And this made all the difference. It meant that in spite of people being what we are like, being individualistic, being cantankerous in all sorts of ways, in spite of that, there was continuity and there was progress. Because individuals were actually developing, then the projects with which they were working could also develop and grow. And that's what I found when I first came along. It was a very tangible thing that people had this common framework, common idea. I feel fortunate that I came along to Tri Ratna at a time when we were still in the first flush of excitement in building up residential communities, team-based right livelihood businesses, or co-ops as we used to call them then. I was idealistic and energetic, and there was plenty for me to throw myself into, and the movement needed me. And by the way, we used to use that word a lot, the word movement. We talked about the movement and talked about ourselves as a movement. And I like that term. We are a movement. You could say we're a movement of idealistic energy endeavouring to create ourselves anew and create a new world. So our movement, this Tri Ratna community, it needs a new generation of people who are willing and able to wholeheartedly throw themselves into building new, call them what you will, co-ops, new team-based right livelihood businesses, new residential communities of all kinds. Because one of the things about this sort of new society idea is there's nothing fixed about it. We can have communities of men and women, communities of young and old, communities, I don't know, you think it, you name it, you can try it, experiment with it. All new Dharma centres, new Buddhist centres. So our movement needs people who can take initiative, who can make mistakes, fall over, pick themselves up, and learn, and even laugh, and enjoy the adventure of a life lived, you could say a life lived a bit on the edge, a life lived without a safety harness, yeah? Our movement needs people who are willing to take risks for the sake of their own growth and development, and for the sake of trying to create and model a better way of living, a better world in a way. Now, I deliberately don't say young people, yeah? Because I know now that I'm not young anymore, that it's not just young people who can be idealistic. Yeah? It's not just young people who are energetic, and it's not just young people who can take risks. Yeah? In fact, sometimes those with more experience are more capable of taking those risks and taking those initiatives. So that's one kind of inspiration. Being inspired to create a better world. That's you could say it's a compassionate vision. A compassionate vision. A compassionate vision of the world and a compassionate vision of what we are capable of, what we can do. And as you can see, that's the vision that fired me and still fires me, yeah? Now, other people may be inspired by something else. For instance, by the pursuit of truth, a vision of wisdom. They may be led to study and meditate deeply. They may even sacrifice wealth or other kinds of security in the pursuit of knowledge and the pursuit of deeper realizations. When I was thinking about this, I was reminded, strangely enough, not of a Buddhist, but I was reminded of someone, William Herschel, whom some of you will know about. William Herschel and his sister, Caroline. Now, William Herschel lived, I think it was probably the early part of the 19th century. He was a musician, a German musician, from a family of musicians. And he came to England. He got a job here. I think he got work as a musician, basically. But in his 30s, when he was in his 30s, he developed a keen interest in astronomy. And just to quote, Richard Holmes has written about him. He says, about William Herschel and his sister, he says, their passion for observational astronomy came absolutely to rule both their lives. At its height in the 1780s, so it's a bit earlier than I thought, brother and sister spent night after night, month after month, summer and especially winter, alone but together in the open air under a changing canopy of stars and planets. Their minutely recorded telescope observations, published in over 100 papers by the Royal Society, would have changed not only the public conception of the solar system, but of the whole Milky Way galaxy and the structure and meaning of the universe itself. So they did this like 365 days a year. They were out there observing the night sky with a telescope, making detailed notes and whatever. They were just absolutely passionate about it. And that's the kind of passion, that's the kind of energy that's required in the pursuit of wisdom. It's not an easy path. Some people are inspired by this single-minded pursuit of knowledge and wisdom. This thirst to know the truth about the universe, to know the nature of reality. And Tree Ratna needs people like that as well. Then there are those whose inspiration lies in the pursuit of beauty. Those with an artistic bent, the poets, the painters, the composers, even the meditators, they may want to capture the beauty of reality, the ecstasy of higher states of consciousness. I think the famous example from the Pali Canon is Nanda, who was reputed to be living the holy life for the sake of going to a heaven where he could be with 500 dove-footed nymphs. That was his motivation. But he did become enlightened. Yeah. The motivation took him that far. Bhante has talked about the arts as a path to higher states of consciousness. This is a quote from Pieces of Fire. He says, the spiritual aspirant is like Shelley's skylark. While his understanding soars, his emotions sing. It is in this singing and soaring, in the simultaneous expansion of the understanding and emotions, that we find the meaning of Buddhism and the value of art. In fact, the secret of spiritual life. So in our movement, we also need artists, and we need to educate ourselves in the arts. I think this is an aspect of the centre here that probably needs to be developed. So if you have any ideas about that, let me know. So as I said earlier, we're often motivated to seek a spiritual path or to take up spiritual practice because of suffering of one kind or another. Again, as Bhante puts it, if one is unhappy, one wants to know the reason why. But it never occurs to one to ask why one is happy. It is therefore unhappiness rather than happiness that causes us to reflect upon our condition. It is unhappiness that makes us think. And then, having thought and maybe searched, we find a path of practice that works, and we're inspired to practice. We're inspired by other people. We're inspired by those a little further along the path who embody, to some degree, the fruits of practice. And this can lead us into communication, into friendship, which provides further inspiration. So the spiritual community is a source of inspiration. It's you could say the spiritual community is a kind of mutual inspiration. I was talking to Subhadramati, who's coming to give a talk in 2 weeks' time. I was talking to her recently, and she asked me this question. I can't remember how it arose, but she asked me, what inspires me? And I said, without thinking too much, I said, the order inspires me. Order members inspire me. And then I said, you inspire me, Subhadramati. Yeah? Because I remember... Well, what I said to her is, I remember you as a newcomer, I remember you coming along, and now I see you as Mitra Convener, a preceptor, the author of a book on ethics, ordaining people who look to you for spiritual guidance. So what a journey of growth that is. And that is what inspires me, seeing people do that, follow that journey. And it's not just Subhadramati. I've seen many, many other people doing that. Many people in, Artapriya sitting over there. I've known Artapriya for over 30 years. And we're both still young and idealistic. I've seen, well, Artapriya's probably seen me. We've seen each other change so much over that period of time. It's very inspiring seeing people change. Anybody who teaches the Dharma or whatever is always talks about how inspiring it is to see people learn to meditate and blossom and expand and become happier, become more aware. So it's very inspiring, may we long continue to inspire each other. So the Sangha, in a sense, is another, it's a fourth sight. That wandering mendicant represents the Sangha as well. And yes, we're also inspired by the Dharma. When we encounter the Dharma, we enter a palace of many rooms, all connected with each other, and each new room opening out to new vistas, new perspectives. The Dharma enlarges our view of life, and it sheds light on areas of unclarity. It elevates us, it gives us a bigger perspective on who we are and why we're alive. The Dharma is very inspiring, it's even awe-inspiring, very inspiring. It's got inexhaustible treasures to be discovered by study, meditation, reflection, discussion, exploration. Certainly, I've been reading the Dharma, studying the Dharma for over 30 years, and I haven't exhausted it. I don't think Artapriya has exhausted it. I'm not sure. I know Bhante Sangharakshita has been doing it for 70 years, probably, and he hasn't exhausted it. So the Dharma consists of teachings, and those teachings are a reflection of reality. And it's possible for us to come to know the Dharma. It's possible for us to embody the Dharma. It's possible for us to be the Dharma. And that's inspiring. So the Dharma is, in a sense, another sight, as it were, when we experience the Dharma, whether through reading suttas. I was reading something written by an order member today. He was talking about reading the Diamond Sutra out loud. He'd been doing this on a retreat. He'd they had a retreat. I think it was at Padmaloka at Christmas. They had a retreat on a diamond sutra, and he was reading it out loud as part of the retreat. And he said, he talked about what an effect it had on him and on other people. Some of the other people were in tears, but they didn't quite know why. It was just the Dharma was having that effect on them. The profundity, the sublimity of the Dharma was having that effect. So the Dharma is a fourth sight. It was the teaching of the five precepts that converted me to Buddhism. That was the first Dharma teaching I heard, and I became a Buddhist as a result of hearing that. I just found those five precepts so attractive when I first heard them. And as it happens, over the years, I've focused on the 10 precepts as an order member as my main practice. Another teaching I personally find very beautiful and very moving is the parable of the rain cloud in the White Lotus Sutra. Anyway, I'm sure you all have your own favourite teachings that inspire and delight. In the Pali Canon, it often says at the end of a sutta, the Buddha gives a teaching or something. It often says at the end that those hearing the teaching, those hearing the Buddha teaching, were aroused, delighted, and inspired. Yeah, or roused, delighted, satisfied, something like that. What it means is they were inspired. That's what it means. So we can be inspired by the Dharma, inspired by others in the Sangha, inspired by beauty, inspired by wisdom, inspired by compassion, inspired by the building of a better world. There are many, many ways we can be inspired. Overall, you could say we're inspired by a vision of a higher life, a vision of ourselves transformed into an embodiment of wisdom and compassion. We're inspired by a vision of the whole of humanity fulfilling its potential by being transformed. A vision of humanity without greed and hatred, a vision of humanity filled with love and generosity. A vision of a world in which people embody loving kindness. And that's a vision of curing the world's sickness by treating the causes rather than the symptoms. It's a big, big vision. It's a vision. It's not not something we're expecting to happen tomorrow or even in our lifetimes. It's a vision to motivate us to move us forward. And every journey towards that vision, every journey towards an ideal, begins with a first step. So when we respond to the call of this vision, when inspiration lights us up, our first step is to work on ourselves. Our first step is to know ourselves and to honestly and with kindness acknowledge our faults and our strengths, our needs and our gifts. So firstly, we need to take responsibility for our own minds, for all our mental states, both good and bad, greedy and generous, happy and sad, angry and kind, confident and fearful. I say that because sometimes when people hear about being responsible for their own mental states, they assume it means being responsible for negative or unskillful mental states. But actually, you need to also be responsible for, or take responsibility in the sense of acknowledging as your own mental states, your skillful mental states as well, your positive mental states, because that gives you confidence. That gives you confidence in who you are and what you're capable of and in your potential. It's very important. So secondly, we need to work with honesty to cultivate better mental states and to dissolve our egotism. And this is where all our practices come in. Our practices of ethics, meditation, study, puja, friendships, reflection, all of them come in this honestly cultivating better mental states. Yeah. And thirdly, we need to create the best possible conditions for our own spiritual development by being in communication and in cooperation with the Sangha and befriending others. That's where the conditions are. The soil out of which we grow is the Sangha. We don't go it alone. And then fourthly, we need to stay in touch with our sources of inspiration. We need to know what inspires us and stay in touch. Try and stay in touch with our sources of inspiration. And have faith that a life well lived is a powerful influence for good in the world. And that being part of the spiritual community makes it an even stronger influence for good. So that's what it means to respond to the four sights, and especially to the fourth sight. As Bhante puts it in his lecture called Breaking Through into Buddhahood, he says, Buddhism has to transform every aspect of our lives and be not just something that we theoretically understand, not just a little hobby with which we occupy ourselves once or twice a week, but the transforming agent, the transforming influence, the catalyst, if you like, of our lives. So responding to the four sights means going forth from attachment to worldly success and security and putting faith and confidence in spiritual potential, spiritual practice and spiritual community. And what going forth is all about is what Subhadramati is going to talk about on the 3rd of February. So thank you for listening. So we're going to have a tea break now, and